Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the bowels, the sausage-making factory of North Carolina policy, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi, glad to have you along. As we record this on a Thursday, yes, a Thursday, June 14th, from the North Carolina legislature, along with Lauren Horsch, we are here to, I don't know, maybe make some sense of some of the things that happened this week. But we will note, as I think I've already said Thursday twice, it is Thursday. That's the third reminder for listeners. And by the time many people listen to this, who the heck knows what might happen overnight as we head into Friday morning?
Does Friday exist? I don't even know.
Friday is an extension of Thursday. It's like Thursday, and
well,
then we get into
Saturday. I think we might want to note the time. It's like 6:30 on Thursday, lawmakers have taken their second recess so they can go get dinner, and they'll come back at 8 and 8:30, and they'll just get down to more business. We don't know what could happen. Anything can happen.
Anything can happen. That is truly the case. Anything can happen. I don't have the dashboard up in front of me. The dashboard is kind of the interactive tool where you can follow along with policy throughout the day. And I believe the House moved through 38 bills today.
Yeah, it was
roughly three dozen. We can say that. I'll note one thing off the top. I just want to put that pin there for you because it is Flag Day. Do you celebrate? That's a Massachusetts flag lapel pin, which probably has no interest to you. But do you have any? You have sneakers on today, which isn't necessarily normal attire for you. Not calling you out, they're fun sneakers, but are you doing anything specific for Flag Day?
I am not doing anything specific for Flag Day because I am unpatriotic and forgot. Ooh. But I like to think I'm a little bit more patriotic than most people because my birthday is July 5th. So I like to think I was just a little bit of a late firecracker there.
Well, happy late birthday. Was that a... No, that wasn't a... I had a nephew that was just born two Saturdays ago. Yeah. All right, we're going to try to focus here. Clearly, this week has... I think it's been exhausting. We'll start big picture and just note that the process of this week, and I was complaining... I've complained to several people this week, and I don't mean for this to be a critique of the Republicans who are leading the legislature, because... According to everybody who's been here a lot longer than I have, who have been here through Democratic leadership, this is just how it's done. And we see this, right? Like we've seen it in Congress. We see it in other states. I, maybe being too much of an idealist, harken back at times to why. Like, why do we have to ram and cram everything through so quickly and so many things? And I don't know. I don't think there's a good reason.
No, and I don't have that answer for you either. I mean, you just kind of look at whatever party is in power, whether that be Republicans, Democrats, or who's it, what's it's, they want to get their agenda through. And especially with this being the short session, I mean, once we gavel out on whatever day we decide to gavel out on, they're done. And they don't technically have to come back unless the governor calls them back for whatever reason or they call themselves back for another reason. And that's when we get all those special sessions we had in 2016. Mm-hmm. It's because that even year, all the even years are short legislative years. So we only have a couple of months to do everything we would do in a regular year, and we've already expedited it with the state budget being done. So, you know, who knows what's next?
They've moved quickly around here. Let's start, and I could ask for three stories of the week. I think we're going to get into a number of different topics, but I do this from time to time on the podcast. What was your story of the week? What is your story of the week as we sit here chatting at 6:30 on a Thursday?
I mean, I've been watching all sorts of things. I think on the forefront of a lot of people's minds is the Farm Act, which is kind of an annual bill by Senator Brent Jackson, who's a Republican from Sampson County. And this year, it's an omnibus bill, which means it has a lot of legislation about a lot of different things. So when it started, when Senator Jackson brought it out, it had legislation for selling certain merchandise at the state fair, having cloned seeds of industrial hemp. And the big one, it updated
some of it non-controversial.
Yeah, a lot of it non-controversial. And I'm not even going to get into the milk provision because that's a different thing, which will come up in a bit.
Raw milk.
Not just raw milk.
Sorry, okay. Milk juice
you're,
and raw
you're,
milk. I'm
you're
sorry.
Jumping the cow to be
I
right.
I apologize. Let me shut my mouth.
So a lot of it was non-controversial, but there is a big chunk of it that is controversial, and it changes the way the nuisance laws in the state act. And, you know, this comes after a big court decision against a pork producer, Murphy Brown, I do believe. Mm-hmm. I haven't been following the court case as much as I have because I've been following this building. But so essentially that just changes how that works and would allow any, you know, standard practice of farming to be not considered a nuisance. And in some pork farms, you know, a standard operating procedure is what some people call hog lagoons, which is really where some of the fecal matter and waste just kind of collect. And you can also spray some of that.
Poop spray, poop piles.
Yes, poop spraying, yeah. So those are standard procedures in a lot of hog farms. And that can, you know, for neighbors, that is a nuisance. That smell is not nice. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm used to smelling hog farms. I'm not necessarily bothered by it. It reminds me of driving to my grandpa's house every summer. But for some people, there's health risks. I mean, I was only smelling that for, you know, 45 minutes driving to the country. But some people are living in it, and that has, you know, health effects too. So there's just been a lot of back and forth on this. And I think it really came to a head, I would say, in the House the past couple of nights. I think it was yesterday and today. We had a lot of debate. And this is where we slipped in a provision about raw milk. If this bill passes the Senate tonight on a concurrence vote, there's a provision in there for you can now have raw milk in the state, which you couldn't previously have. But it also has a provision saying, you know, that almond milk and that soy milk you get at the store because you might be lactose intolerant or just don't like the idea of drinking milk because you're a vegan or vegetarian, that can no longer be described as milk because it is not from a hooved mammal. And so hooved mammals, goats, cows, what have you. I forget all the hooved mammals. There's a lot of them.
Alpacas?
I would assume so.
I would assume so.
Yeah. So, because you can't really milk a nut. I mean, I've made my own, you know, nut milk, and it's a process, but you're not going out there, you know, touching udders and stuff, because I've also milked cows, so I know that process too.
Seven minutes in, we've got poop juice and udders already making an appearance on the podcast this week. Why not?
You're welcome.
It's been a crazy week.
My grandpa had a dairy farm. I know what I'm doing here.
Let me note a couple of things. One, I believe I introduced you. I believe I said
Lauren my name, Horsch,
but I didn't say NC Insider. Lauren is, of course, with the NC Insider. You're a return guest to the podcast, so perhaps I'm just being presumptuous.
Hopefully, loyal listeners remember me.
Specific to this Farm Act, I guess I would note one thing, which is for anybody that has driven to Wilmington before, which you and I both have done many times, mm-hmm. there is often a stretch going through Duplin County yep. where you get this strong aroma, and I would just, you know, note, imagine living near that.
Yes.
Imagine that being part of your regular routine.
You would wake up to it. You would go to bed to it. It would be there when you shower. It would be there, you know, just every day. Yeah, and Jimmy Dixon, Representative Jimmy Dixon, who is a Republican from Duplin County, he's kind of been championing the bill in the House. And yeah, it was just the debate from all of it. And you heard Republican Representative John Blust from Guilford County stand up and kind of blast the process mm-hmm. today. It was, I think, one of the biggest debates. I don't remember the exact quote, but he said, "The Iron Curtain has fallen on the General Assembly and won't let go." So that's just kind of an idea of what kind of process has been happening here. There's some people who are very unhappy with just slamming these bills through.
So it is certainly process that is part of what I would say. It's not necessarily a rift of Republicans, but there is a faction of Republicans who have broken off from this bill. Some of it is due to the process. Some of it has to do with just this fundamental question of where is the line between personal property rights and protections yeah. for major corporations. It was a very interesting debate. It was a lively discussion. Mm-hmm. We really should have dubbed John Blust Mr. Process years ago.
I think he's been known as Mr. Process because he's shut down bills before because the process hasn't gone through like it should.
But has that nickname maintained, like Mr. Perfect, right? From
no.
like WWE.
Yeah.
I mean, Blust.
There's no nature boy here.
There's like, no nature boy here. All right, well played. The process piece of it was part of it. That also you know this
but
liberty,
lot,
this fundamental liberty
yes.
question.
A lot of people had concerns about the nuisance because, you know, these people have a right to, like, they own this property next to a farm. Like, they should have some sort of recourse. And, you know, some of the neighbors to this Murphy Brown farm, you know, they've gone through all the process.
Right.
And there's a lot going on with that court case still. But they went through the entire process, and according to the courts, they're owed a certain amount of money.
Right.
Because
they do have a recourse,
yes.
As is present,
yeah.
present under, you know, current
but
statutory
it would,
language.
But this bill would take big chunks of that away, and, you know, property rights people are very upset about this because, you know, obviously it infringes upon that.
It's going to be interesting to see if the Senate concurs, and then if, in fact, they do, this will go to the governor. Mm-hmm. I assume he will veto this. And then it becomes an interesting math equation as to whether or not there are enough votes or there can be enough arms twisted in the House for this to be overridden. So the NC Farm Act, certainly one of the most interesting things that has moved this week at the General Assembly. I want to ask you to give us an update about the issue of rape kits and the backlog of rape kits at local law enforcement offices mm-hmm. around the state. That's something you've written about, and there has been more movement on
yes.
this week.
Yeah, I feel like I've written about it extensively, almost daily, it seems like. So one distinction I really need to make is that this quote-unquote backlog we were talking about is from local law enforcement agencies. It is not the state crime lab. So what happened was in last year's state budget, the State Department of Justice had to go through and kind of do an inventory, an audit on how many sexual assault evidence kits were in the possession of local law enforcement. So for Durham, where I live, at the Durham Police Department, there were 1,711 kits sitting somewhere. I don't know, you know, if it was a closet, if it was like a perfect evidence room. We don't know. But so because of that, the state found over 15,000 untested rape kits. And
which is a lot. And I would just note Durham disproportionately high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not good, bad,
for
or
whatever,
different, but just
yes.
for yeah, the numbers of it.
So with that, they wanted the, you know, Attorney General Josh Stein was asking for money to test these kits. And each kit is expensive to test. I think it's about $700. So in total, to test all of the untested rape kits from across the state, it would cost over $10 million. It's like $10.6 million something. He didn't get any money. He was asking for $2 million to start with. He didn't get that. But instead, as part of his recommendation about these kits, he wanted to start, and the Department of Justice wanted to start, a rape kit tracking system. So much like any of us who order packages from Amazon or any other online mm-hmm. retailer, we get a number. And we can type that number into UPS, FedEx, wherever we, you know, who's ever shipping our package. And we can see where that is. I can see, you know, today it's in Fairfax, Virginia.
Right.
So what this tracking system would do for rape kits would essentially give every rape kit an individualized ID barcode that would then be given to a survivor of the assault or the rape, depending on, you know, what actually happens. And then that person can go in and check the status. They can see, okay, my kit is at the hospital, or, oh, my kit is, you know, in the possession of the district attorney. And that also really helps the victim kind of see, you know, how their case is, you know, moving through, progressing through the court system if
right.
they're prosecuted.
If it isn't right.
But there's been a lot of drama because with these 15,000 rape kits, we don't need to test all of them. And I should say, you know, maybe we should test all of them. I don't really know. But a lot of the victims and survivors have said, you know, I don't want my kit tested for whatever reason. So that's, I want to say, about, you know, a third of them. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. But some have said, you know, I don't want my kit tested, so please don't test it. So with this tracking system, there's also a working group that will look at that 15,000 number and dive down really deep and see which ones need to be tested. And when these are tested, you often find serial offenders. I just recently in Fayetteville, they tested a kit from, you know, the early millennium, and they were able to find a guy who had, you know, committed an offense before, and they arrested right. him. So this is, you know, when you test these kits, it has real life results for a lot of women and a lot of children or men who are victims of sexual assault.
Is there an expiration on these kits? How long? I mean, if there was a kit that had been backlogged somewhere sitting in a local law enforcement agency's office since 1986, can that still be tested?
I don't know the rules of DNA as much as I used to. I was a crime reporter for
right.
a long time. But it would just depend on how much DNA is there, because
okay.
you have to have a certain amount of DNA for it to be reasonably tested.
Okay. Whether it's blood or semen or
yes.
skin or hair, sweat particle or whatever it may
yeah,
be.
Yeah, so okay. it'll depend on the quality of the DNA and the quantity of the DNA, because you can't test certain, you know, certain strains of DNA. But I don't know if there is an expiration date per se, like there would be on milk or cheese. But, you know, you can reasonably test most kits as long as there is DNA, to my knowledge.
You can keep track of what Lauren is keeping track of during the week with her musings on Twitter at Lauren Horsch, H-O-R-S-C-H. You can keep track of some of the stories that we're talking about here on the podcast on our website, WUNC.org. I would note there was a technical corrections bill that moved through this week, among other things. I'm going to throw out a couple and feel free to jump in if I'm missing something that is of interest. It restored funding for a suicide prevention hotline that was, we believe, accidentally left out of the budget, probably in part because the budget process took place so quickly. Mm-hmm. There was a $200,000 earmark that was intended for some schools in northern Mecklenburg County, the district of Senator Jeff Tarter, a Republican who's facing a tight reelection campaign. That earmark was removed because the nonprofit that was effectively told, you're going to, you know, disperse these funds, that nonprofit said, we don't want to do this. This is a more or less a political stunt. So that $200,000 was removed. And one more for good measure, there's another $27 million appropriated for veterans' homes, one in the triangle, one in the triad. So this is an annual exercise, the technical corrections bill, which can have it can have some major things in it. It's been known to.
Yeah, what did one, I miss? One big fix, I think, for listeners in the triangle was
right.
The Durham Orange Light Rail transit system is kind of saved. We haven't really figured it out, but in the budget bill, it had essentially killed the project.
Right.
And now there's some new recourse for getting $190 million worth of funding, which is pennies compared to the 2.678 whatever billion it's going to cost for this light rail to begin with. But local officials in Durham and Orange are very excited about this. And Senator Floyd McKissick, who's one of the senators from Durham, worked really hard. He set up a conference call with Senator Berger and other leading Republicans in the Senate to figure out this fix, because it is something really important for Durham and Orange that public officials have been wanting for years. I think they've been working on a regional transit system since before I was born.
Yeah, so. It's been a while. I hear from, I've lived in the state almost 12 years now, and I'll hear from people who have been here 20 years and say they've been talking about this since I moved here. So the GO Triangle, I believe, needs to, yes, procure these additional private funds. They've got until next April to do it, and that would keep the door open on.
Yes.
Getting the federal funds, and then if the federal funds come in, the state funds come in.
We'll
follow after that.
The state funds have to follow the federal funds. So
let's talk early voting briefly. A proposal on the House side. Again, it's Thursday as we talk. It has been voted on the House for its second reading.
Yes, it's only had one vote in the House.
In theory, be in the House again on Friday, and then would move over to the Senate. But what this House proposal does, as we understand it, in this, when things move quickly and emerge late at night, they morph, and you don't necessarily understand them immediately because it all happens in the darkness of night. What this does is it moves the final Saturday of early voting to the front end of early voting to a Wednesday, and we know that last Saturday is overall pretty popular with voters, and it is one of the most popular early voting days when it comes to African Americans, and we know that by and large African Americans vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
So oversimplifying here, and there also this also gives a requirement that counties have to have early voting sites open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. during the week, and they can't just have one or two of the early voting sites open. If it's a county that has multiple early voting sites, they all have to be open for that 12-hour stretch.
Yes, they call this uniform. Uniformity in early voting hours.
I smell a lawsuit of some sort down the line on this.
This is North Carolina. We like to sue against our legislation as much as we can. You're right. This is, it's still morphing. We're still learning more and more about this. One thing that was very confusing in the committee meeting this morning about it was there was confusion as to weekend hours. So we have that mandate 12 hours, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. But what about the weekend hours?
Right.
Well, that's up to the counties.
It's up to I believe it's already up to the counties.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And this doesn't effectively change that.
So right now, counties do have the ability to say, okay, I want, we need this many early voting stations on, these days during the prescribed amount of early voting, the early voting period, and they can set their hours. But now, they can't set their hours during the weekday, but they can set their hours during the weekend, and they can still choose the locations of their early voting hours. But some opponents to the bill have been saying, by mandating that 12-hour time period, you're really putting, you know, a squeeze on the budgets of these local election boards because you have to pay these poll workers. So usually if it's only if the polls open 8 hours, now you have to, you know, spread money more.
Sure.
Because it's open 12 hours instead, and you have to find more people to, you know, pass out the ballots, put the ballots in the counter.
Right, you got to staff it,
yes,
right?
And it's going to be hard to find that many staffers because it's already kind of hard to find poll staffers to begin with during these long voting, early voting sessions. And to your point about this last Saturday of the early voting period, proponents of this bill have been saying, you know, no matter what day is the last day of early voting, there's going to be a ton of people there because we procrastinate. We're humans. Mm-hmm. We're going to put it off until the last minute. So there's just a lot of, you know, each side is very heated, and it's just, it's interesting to see how this will morph because there's still more things coming out as we go on. Because I think I recently saw that the decision for the voting schedule would have to be unanimous. And then if it's not unanimous
at the county
level, at the county level, it would have to be unanimous. And then it would move up. If it's not unanimous, it would move up to the state board. But I don't know what recourse the state board has there to fix that. So
and,
there's
and
still
they might. Yeah, right. They might not have to weigh in on it.
And not even that. There's a whole new level of this. There is an emergency state board of elections meeting called at 11:15 while this bill was being heard in committee.
In response to this bill, really.
Yeah, really in response to it, because there's a couple election bills floating out there. And so this meeting was really about asking for, you know, 24 hours heads up of when a bill could come.
The state board of elections would like more time. Well, let me back up
you
a
back
second.
Up, yes.
Some members of the state board of elections would like more time, more of a heads up from the North Carolina legislature when there are election laws coming their way. But we did hear from some members, and I just heard bits and pieces of the call today. There was at least one Republican member on the State Board of Elections who said that this is not their place. He doesn't want the board to become more political than it already is. Or this is he called this, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, a political stunt by some of the Democratic members of the board. So, yes, more theater and theatrics and drama. And hey, at least there is, and I guess it's what I need to get
at least
right
there's
now,
a board.
A bipartisan elections and ethics board because we didn't have a board for whatever it was, a year and a half.
I don't know. Josh Lawson tweeted at me, tell me how long. But yeah,
it
was
a
long time.
Right. All right. You get the idea. There are a lot of things that we're moving this week. I want to ask you a question. We talk about process so much. What is your process for a busy week like this? There's so much that's going on. You're a good writer. You're a good reporter. You just can't cover it all. Nobody in this press room can cover it all. What's your approach to handling some of it?
So we get the ins that are lucky so there's two of us. So I know who my coworker is on any given day, and I have a great – Colin and I have a great working relationship. We can, you know, just, you know, text each other, call each other, whatever. We get it done. So we actually work shifts. So I'm usually the morning reporter. So on busy days, if there's an 8:30 meeting, a 9 a.m. meeting, which there was today, I come in bright and early and I set everything up for the day. I figure out what meetings are going through. And then I cover the morning meetings as much as I can, taking notes, recording it, because I do record everything. And then he comes in, you know, 11, noon, 1 p.m., whatever the day dictates. And then, you know, we work together during those big afternoon hours. And then at night, I leave around 7 or 8. But, I mean, it's really just a process of going through these committee agendas and seeing, okay, this bill we don't know much about. Let's look more into that. Because the Insider has this great ability where we can, you know, use content from WUNC, WRL, other, you know, places because we're essentially a wire service and we can help grab all that.
Right.
So if there's a big story, say this election law thing, my colleague Lynn Bonner at the News and Observer was writing the big story. So I knew we would have that from her so I could focus on the little bills and House rules instead. So I have a couple stories out of House rules that are not focused on that election bill. So we really look for the smaller things, but we also have to make sure everything's comprehensive. It's stressful, but we get it done.
It is a subscription-based service, and you mostly serve lobbyists and other political types?
Lobbyists, lawmakers, business insiders.
Celebrating
sort of
25 years, the NC Insider? Yeah.
1993. I think it was January 27th, 1993 is when we were first released via fax.
All right. We're going to fire you through some rapid ones before we wrap it up here. First one is, what is your favorite committee room?
Favorite committee room? I'm really oddly partial to 544 in the legislative office building. I know TV reporters are not, but I have like one specific chair that I sit in and everyone knows me there. And like, so I mean, any room, the sergeant at arms know who I am because I'm in almost every committee meeting there is.
Yes, you are.
So 544 is just, it's the right amount of space. You can see all the lawmakers. You still get good sound. So that's why I like it.
How many times have you seen Bull Durham?
Five. Which is really low considering I'm a huge Bull Durham fan and huge Durham Bulls fan.
When was the last or when was the next Bulls game that you'll go to?
I will be going to one tomorrow night.
Saturday.
Yes,
no,
which is
Friday.
Friday. The 30th anniversary of Bull Durham, which premiered on June 15th, 1988.
Wow.
1988. So they're showing clips on that.
Oh, that's pretty neat. My sister will never hear this, but I should note that my sister turns 30 on Saturday, which is June 16th. You're a Durhamite. We were actually talking about margaritas as we walked into the studio here to tape this podcast. What's the best margarita in Durham?
Oh, it's a toughie. So this is going to be a sleeper choice, and people are going to not like it if you're a big margarita drinker in Durham. But I really like the margarita at 106 Main. It's just a classic margarita. There's nothing much to it, but it's the atmosphere of 106 Main because it's kind of an off-the-beaten-track bar in downtown Durham.
No frozen, maybe a jalapeno margarita here and there?
I do like the jalapeno margarita at Blue Note Grill, but yes, I'm a rocks and salt girl.
All right. Something on your summer bucket list?
I hadn't thought that far through.
It's not technically summer yet. It is still spring.
My boyfriend and I have a collective goal of starting an annual summer party tradition. So we're trying to figure out a theme because we have one friend who always throws a 4th of July party. So we're trying to figure out what our annual party could be.
Nice. As in something you would host or as in like, let's go to Miami and rave?
No, something we would host.
Okay. All right. Final one. Pick your poison. What is the controversy that's going to emerge tonight? Let me rephrase. What is the controversial bill or topic that we perhaps will be talking or texting about 12 hours from now?
So there's two ways this could go down. It could be a bill we don't expect at all, because that often happens. But
family values, guns, abortion.
Yes. However, it'll be interesting to see how the farm bill, which we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, plays out. I've heard that Senator Jackson, Brent Jackson from Sampson, who's the lead sponsor of that bill, is going to call for concurrence.
Oh, interesting.
But we'll see how it goes because that raw milk provision really rubs people the wrong way. So I think that debate will be interesting because they took out the other alcohol bill, House Bill 500, which was the alcohol beverage control omnibus bill. That also was not concurred, and we didn't have a lot of debate on that. So that was the other controversy I was looking out for, but that went down. So,
and that one, correct me if you see it differently, I don't think it's going to go to conference and emerge in the next 12 to 18 hours. I think that bill is dead until the long session.
They've got other things to do.
We have other things to do as well. You have about an hour, I think. We have an hour before the House comes back in. Lauren Horsch, the NC Insider, as always, thank you for the insight and knowledge on the podcast.
Glad to be here, Jeff.
Thanks for tuning in and listening and trying to have some enjoyment and understanding of what is happening in your government on a quickly moving week here in June. You can stay up to date with Lauren, of course, at Lauren Horsch, H-O-R-S-C-H on Twitter, and at our website, WUNC.org. Subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. Tell your friends, neighbors, and colleagues about it as well. Thanks, as always, for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.